This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we've got memory, history, and a trip into your neighborhood this hour. A year after Hurricane Sandy, an enterprising reporter reminds us just how much some neighborhoods in the New York area have changed forever and how people are holding on to some very bitter memories. We're going to also look at some alarming historical similarities between Vladimir Putin's Russia and the Russia of Joseph Stalin, and how technology helps consumers write the biographies of the products they buy, the good and the bad. But first, more than 3 weeks since the launch of the most complicated aspects of the Affordable Care Act, federal and state-based health care exchanges, the website healthcare.gov, you may have heard that things are not exactly going as smoothly as, say, unpacking a brand new shiny smartphone.
Things like error messages that may appear on a screen or certain pages going blank, things freezing. Those are the kinds of things that we are prioritizing in terms of putting in place software fixes.
Julie Batte there, communications director of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, just one of the conference calls, part of the federal effort to get the problems with the Affordable Care Act under control. But we want to step away from the federal finger-pointing and the macro outrage over all of this and actually see what's happening in local communities. We'd love to hear, for instance, how healthcare may be changing in your own neighborhood from all of this. How is the ACA rollout going in your home state? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. There are huge differences around the country, as you're going to see now. First, take Texas. We welcome Veronica Zaragovia, KUT reporter from KUT Austin. Welcome, Veronica.
Thank you. Hi, John.
It's great to talk to you. In Texas, I gather it sounds like this.
We've had individuals say they've tried to sign up, the website is busy or not working at all. But if we give it a few weeks and we go back, that you're going to have a better chance at, you know, getting through. But not to give up, because there, not only can you go through the internet, you can go through the mail, you can apply in person, you can also apply via the telephone.
So, Veronica, who's talking there, and is don't give up the message in Texas right now?
Yes, that's Angelica Noyola, and she is with a group, Latino Healthcare Forum, here in Austin, that's very active about the outreach to the Latino community. And that's their message, don't give up. And they're not emphasizing the website because in some parts of Austin, for instance, one very low-income Latino neighborhood, Dove Springs, one out of two people are either not computer literate or don't have a computer. So they're emphasizing the 1-800 number and the paper application.
And really the issue there is not so much the website, but enabling the experts and the person-to-person infrastructure to try to get the message out.
Absolutely. And what's been really interesting is to see, you know, who's taking a lead and helping inform people. For instance, what's really interesting, last night here in Austin, Univision had from 5 p.m. till about 10 p.m., each hour they had a one-minute cut into the programming where they were urging viewers to call a 1-800 number where they could get help from a certified application counselor with questions. And so that's one example of people filling the gap.
Well, hold on there for just a moment. Veronica Zaragovia at KUT in Austin, Texas. Next up, Ohio. Joe Inglis is reporter and producer for Ohio Public Radio's Statehouse News. Hello, Joe.
Hello.
So Ohio has a really unique story, and we're going to let Amy Farnsworth from Athens County, Ohio, help us tell it.
While I care for my son and my husband and am the only person who can take them to their appointments, which are about 2 hours away for each of them, I cannot take advantage of the Affordable Care Act.
Now, Amy Farnsworth was talking about Medicaid expansion, which the legislature was resisting in Ohio, and it was affecting her, Amy, who spoke with us 3 weeks ago, directly. That situation, Joe Inglis, has really changed all of a sudden.
It has. You know, the situation has been that we didn't have the Medicaid expansion through the legislature. The Republican legislature didn't want to do it, didn't pass it, didn't like it in the form that it was proposed by the governor. So the governor went around to a legislative panel, and he was able to use that panel to get the legislative expansion. Now we have a lawsuit because the people who filed the lawsuit said it wasn't constitutional to use that panel to get Medicaid expansion in this way. And people like Amy, though, are very happy because they're going to be able, as it stands right now, to get the Medicaid expansion that they wanted.
And has John Kasich, the governor there, the Republican governor, the conservative Tea Party favorite governor there in Ohio, made this a cause celeb?
Well, I don't know if he's exactly the Tea Party favorite right now, because a lot of those conservatives are very upset with him. But, you know, his take on this is he thinks it's the right thing to do. He thinks that you need to expand Medicaid because there are a lot of people in Ohio who are not covered right now. And it will also, ironically, the state's figures show it will save $400 million in Ohio by expanding. So even one of the Republicans who was on that legislative panel that passed the Medicaid expansion through this controlling board process, that Republican is proposing a tax cut, an income tax cut, with the $400 million.
Interesting. $400 million. That's real money. Joe English, reporter and producer for Ohio Public Radio State House News. Hang on there for a second. And here's the sound in the state of Vermont, a state that is unique for a lot of reasons politically. Charlotte Albright is a reporter for Vermont Public Radio. Welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you.
Here's the sound of the ACA story in Vermont.
I know I personally was panicking. And, you know, I picked up the attitude that, forget it, I'm just not going to do health insurance. But it actually went very smoothly, and I'm very happy with it.
They're smiling in Vermont, Charlotte Albright? Who's that?
No, only Louisa Olson. That is whom we just heard from. Some people are smiling and some people aren't. Louisa works for a housing authority, and I met her at a sign-up session at her employer's. One of the reasons she's smiling is that she was able to log in, but at some point in that process, she had to use paper forms. So that's one thing that Vermont is still working on. The website is getting better, but it's still not quite there. The other reason she's smiling is that her employer is quite generous. They're going to kick in 80% of her monthly premium, which is about $400. So she was pleasantly surprised. I can't say every employer is doing that, but I will say that a lot of them are trying to come up with enough money to bridge any gaps that might exist between what employees are used to and what they're about to get.
So to the three of you, what do you think accounts for the differences that we've heard? Joe Inglis?
Well, I think one of the things that we have here in Ohio that maybe other states are not struggling with is we have a Republican legislature that really has not warmed up to the idea at all. But we do have key Republican office holders, including our governor, who likes the idea. So it's kind of here in Ohio, we're kind of facing what we've seen lately at the national level, where you have a Republican split. And even within that Republican split, it splits four or five times, depending on why people are upset or why they don't like it. And so there doesn't seem to be a consensus right now. The Democrats, ironically, agree with the Republican governor. And our advocates here who want the health care, they're thrilled that they're going to be getting it at this point. But everyone's watching the Supreme Court, the Ohio Supreme Court, to see what they do with that lawsuit right now.
Divisions in Ohio. Is there an apparent consensus in Vermont, Charlotte Albright?
Well, I first need to say that Vermont is the only state that has required every single employer with fewer than 50 employees, 50 or fewer, to buy their insurance through the exchange. That's because our Democratic governor has used this as what he hopes is an on-ramp eventually to single payer. So it's mandatory for so many people in Vermont. So I think there's a sense of, okay, we better do this. And the other interesting thing about Vermont is that before this ACA came along, we had a pretty high rate of insured people. We only had 7% uninsured. So everybody is sort of used to paying for insurance. And I think the third thing is that, you know, we have $170 million in federal grants to operate this exchange, and that's real money. And it seems to be something that people are, if not embracing, some people are resigned to it, and other people are thrilled, especially people at the lower end of the economic spectrum who are going to do better than they have before.
Well, Charlotte Albright, certainly the size of the state of Vermont helps here, and the size of the state of Texas is one of the complications. Veronica Zaragovia, before we go down there in Austin, Texas, you're really seeing the sociological issues of trying to really get the message into the various demographic groups that are going to have to buy into this for it to work, right?
Right. And for instance, when we heard from Angelica Noyola earlier, she was talking to me at a car show. And so these people are going out to either a Dia de los Muertos event or wherever they can reach out to the Latino community, because by 2020, it's estimated that the majority of the Texas population will be Hispanic. And this is a state with the highest rate of the uninsured in the country. So it's in the interest of people who want the Affordable Care Act to succeed to get Latinos enrolled.
If you can't succeed with Latinos in Texas, you're not going to succeed at all. Veronica Zaragovia from KUT Austin, Texas, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Joe Inglis, reporter and producer for Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News. Joe, get back to work, and thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
And Charlotte Albright, reporter for Vermont Public Radio. Charlotte, thanks.
It was a pleasure.
So a lot of contrasts around the country in the healthcare rollout. You know, there are a lot of hidden contrasts in the products we buy. Did you know that? Take the supply chain from the raw materials, fibers, plastic, wood, other things, to the assembly floor where workers put products together, wholesale, retail, shipping, all the way to you. It's quite a story. Next up on The Takeaway, we're going to hear about some of the storyteller apps and websites that help you track everything from labor practices to environmental impact to the lobbying activity and political brand of retailers and manufacturers. Are there brands you avoid because of their business practices?
My name is Jared from Georgetown, Indiana. I do choose to boycott certain companies, Genesis Diamond, JC Food Store, Tyson, because I believe that my dollar means a lot. And if I refuse to give them my dollar, then they might change their policy.
Consumer power there from Garrett in Georgetown, Indiana. In Lyndhurst, New Jersey, one of you wrote, I buy food from businesses that support labeling of genetic engineered foods, GE Foods, and I have not purchased fuel from Exxon since the Valdez wreck. You know, knowing the oil market, I bet that's impossible to never purchase fuel from Exxon in some form. John Wheeler wrote on Facebook, I try to buy American-made goods. To me, it's worth the expense that someone here in the States got a paycheck instead of some global distributor.
This is Scott Van Alstein from Dallas, Texas. I don't specifically boycott any particular brands because of their business or trade practices, but I do avoid British Petroleum whenever I can. Given any sort of option, I'll choose the other option other than BP.
From Eugene, Oregon, I use the Buycott app to help avoid Monsanto. I also try to purchase local foods, support local craftspeople. When I shop online, I try to purchase from a vendor close. Deanna Doan wrote on Facebook, Barilla Pasta because of the CEO anti-gay stance. Who is he to say who the right people are to eat his pasta? Deanna, thanks for that. And from New York City, we got this text, Tommy Hilfiger, because of his racist comments in the past. Now, in a shout-out to Reputation.com, anyone who wants to argue with our listeners, free to call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Any companies have a statement to respond to any of what our listener is saying about, listeners are saying about your brands, you're free to go to thetakeaway.org and leave us a comment. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation on any level. Find us, too, at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is sponsored by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom. In theaters, October 18th.
What stories could be told to us by the products we buy? Technology, you know, is enabling consumers to be far more aware of the details of the items they purchase, far beyond brand, price, ingredients, or even the mysterious barcode on every package. The accumulated information of everything that went into the manufacture and sale of products can be collected now and is increasingly accessible to average consumers. Anticipating this and responding to the global scourge of worker exploitation and human trafficking, the state of California has passed the Transparency in Supply Chains Act, requiring certain retailers and manufacturers to publicly disclose how they are addressing forced labor and human trafficking in their supply chain. And this week, a website launched with considerably less fanfare than the Affordable Care Act rollout to open a window for consumers using the new California law. KnowTheChain.org, it's called. Lori Bishop is a director of investments at Humanity United, a nonprofit behind the launch of KnowTheChain.org.
The legislation applies to retailers and manufacturers doing business in California. And in terms of industries, there is a wide spectrum of industries that are covered. Running from IT is actually a really significant industry that meets the criteria outlined in the legislation. Of course, there are a number of apparel and garment companies who are also covered by the law. But the industries where you're going to see the biggest problems, really it's anywhere where you see outsourcing, labor outsourcing, and contract work, and anywhere where there's a significant presence of migrant workers. So that can also be at the raw material level of the supply chain in the production of agricultural or extractive commodities like gold or palm oil.
Lori Bishop, a director of investments at Humanity United, behind the launch of KnowTheChain.org. With me now is Manoush Zamarodi, host of WNYC's New Tech City. Welcome, Manoush.
Hi, John. Great to see you.
So let's talk about this. It goes way beyond tracking slavery and human trafficking. Products can tell a lot of stories.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, other than just the people behind it, there is the product good for you, your health? Is it environmentally friendly? What is its social impact on maybe people not just abroad, but here at home domestically? So what I did, John, was I downloaded a bunch of these apps that purport to give you that information. And let me just show you. So I put them on here. And
you've practically got a shopping cart.
I brought you some goodies. So with this one, you can tap the word scan. This is the good guide. And you put it up to, I have a bottle of Voss water. I don't usually drink fancy water like this, but I got it at a hotel yesterday. I went to an event. You scan it, you pop it, the barcode, take a picture of the barcode, and then it tells you some information. So Voss water, I'm sorry to say, got a 3.4 overall. And then it says behind the ratings, what does this mean? This company's environmental policies, practices, and performance place it among the worst bottom 15% of companies rated by Good Guide. So Voss does not fare well in this.
We don't know what Voss would say in response to that.
We don't know what they would say.
We'd love to know, but consumers right then and there can get that opinion.
I mean, you'd have to be kind of an idiot to think that this big glass bottle was good for the environment every time you're drinking it.
Good point.
So then my breakfast this morning, Chobani yogurt, I was like, well, that sounds good. It's an upstate New York brand, and I looked it up, and it didn't get a good rating either, which surprised me.
And you know the reason for that.
No, tell me.
Actually, WNYC has covered this. Chobani and yogurt, the manufacturer of yogurt, produces enormous waste that needs to be disposed of, and it's a huge problem for the entire industry.
Yeah, so health-wise, I get a 6.9 for eating it, but the environment, it gets a 3.3, and then it gets a 3.8 for society, which is not good. And it says that this company's social policies are in the worst 50%, but it doesn't give me a lot of information why. Now, I need to tell you, Good Guide was sort of the best of the lot that I found. I downloaded a whole bunch of them. A lot of them didn't work. A lot of them didn't have a lot of products listed. Mm. And the idea is great, but John, at the end of the day, how many apps do you have on your phone?
I have a zillion.
Yes. And how many do you actually use?
Not a zillion.
Yes.
You know, maybe three. One question. 3.3 out of a scale of what? Is it 1 to 10?
10, yeah.
So that's generally how it works. And I would think that manufacturers wouldn't necessarily be thrilled about letting a lot of information get out to be evaluated by these groups. So they must be experiencing a headwind, some of these, as they launch.
Yeah, you'd think. So with Good Guide, for example, they have just partnered with Target, actually, to go through and then they say go through all of their products and rate them. So I think that that's going to be the tipping point when the distributors of these products say, you know what, in order for us to come in our store, you need to go through this process.
Some other names for people to try, to check out?
Choco Locate is
nice.
One for ethically sourced chocolate, which obviously I needed to download that one. It's fancy chocolate. I'm not going to CVS to pick up a Cadbury's. I'm going to like the fancy, fancy, fancy chocolate store around the corner. Can I buy a bag of that to hand out at Halloween? Probably not. I can't afford that. Another one that I couldn't get to work, which sounded really interesting, Free to Work, which goes back to the supply chain, the slavery chain mm-hmm. that you were talking about earlier. Another one is called Social Impact. One that I'm really looking forward to actually is called Fairphone. This was a crowdsourced phone that's supposed to be coming to the United States in the new year, that the idea is that all the metals that go into your phone are ethically sourced and not coming from conflict-ridden nations.
So it's actually the phone itself passes a test for supply chain morality, if we want to.
Exactly. Because the irony is when I was doing all of my testing, I was doing it on a phone that got a D rating, the iPhone, not ethically sourced.
Certainly, this is really just the beginning of a trend where consumers are going to have the information and be interested in the information. It won't no longer will be just questions they're asking. They'll be able to get answers.
I mean, at the risk of sounding cynical, John, there has to be a sort of coolness factor to it, right? That there has to be a sense that it's you're branding yourself in a way by saying that I only purchase ethically sourced thing. There is a new fashion company called Zadie. It's a website that tells you the story behind every piece of clothing that you buy. And, you know, that's sort of the place where it needs to start, right? People saying when I get dressed in the morning, I want to look great and I want to be ethically sourced. It's a little I feel torn about it, you know?
But millennials say that the process of going from brand hipness, which they have a lot of information on, to this sort of socially conscious hipness is a straight line for them. That they don't see a real threshold here. That they want to know about brands, but they also want to know about this other stuff. So they're almost ready to go here, even though some of the rest of us might have a little more difficulty getting across this.
That's great. And I think yes, they are definitely more aware than a lot of the rest of us who are skew a little bit older are. But at the end of the day, they can say that. They're still buying the latest iPhone, aren't they?
There you go. Manoush Zomorodi, host of New Tech City, telling consumers to wait. The websites will be up and running, and the questions will be answered about supply chains and everything else regarding our purchases. Manoush, thanks so much.
Great to be here, John.
Manoush Zomorodi is the host of WNYC's New Tech City.
Tickets, please.
Movie Friday with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, our culture producer and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. More about the podcast, including a surprise in a moment. Welcome.
Hi, John.
Thanks, John.
It's great to talk to you. I'm really excited about some of the offerings this week. For instance, The Counselor, Cormac McCarthy's debut screenplay, the cast, Michael Fassbender, Penelope Cruz, Cameron Diaz, Javier Bardem, Brad Pitt.
You seem unsettled.
I'm all right.
I just need you to be sure that you're locked in. I don't know. My recommendation anyway, counselor. Don't do it.
Well, I guess I'm a little taken aback at the cautionary nature of this conversation.
Ridley Scott and Cormac McCarthy, Rafer, it's got to be a happy kind of date movie, right?
Yes, very upbeat, you know, Cormac McCarthy. It's a noir, you know, Michael Fassbender plays an attorney known only as the counselor, no name. He gets involved with some of his sleazeball clients and embarks on a drug deal, and of course, things go south. I expected a lot. I'm a huge fan of Ridley Scott, not so much of Cormac McCarthy. I found this movie surprisingly to be almost unwatchable. I nearly walked out of this film, which I never feel that way. I never walked out of a film. I almost walked out of it. So boring, so dull.
Any hope, Kristen?
You know, if you really love long speeches about cheetahs, long speeches about snuff films, long speeches about smuggling humans.
Poetry.
Any kind of long speech where the other person just stares at the other person talking and kind of nods once in a while. You're going to love this movie.
Kind of like a radio show. The reviews have said, though, that this is too talky.
I mean, I think the problem is, you know, Cormac McCarthy is a novelist. The movies that have been made out of his novels that are best pare away all that verbiage. This one just lets it all sit there.
Well, if you don't like a lot of dialogue in a movie, the next one is exactly what you'd want. All is Lost.
This is Virginia Jean with an SOS call. Over. This is the Virginia Jean with an SOS call. Over.
And that's about all of the voice of Robert Redford you hear in this movie by J.C. Chandor. What do you think, Rafer?
You know, the reviews on this thing have been breathless. All you've got there is Robert Redford as a yachtsman out in the middle of the Indian Ocean trying to stay afloat. I like the movie. I did not think it was great. I think it's trying to make some interesting points, oddly enough, about globalization and commerce, which I don't think you'd expect necessarily from a survival film. I don't think it quite said as much to me as I wanted it to, But Redford's great. It's pretty gripping throughout, and it's definitely a solid film, and very unusual and interesting.
Visual filmmaking, at least that was the appeal for me. For both of you, blue is the warmest color, Palme d'Or at Cannes. What do you think, Kristen?
Yeah, this is a highly controversial film. It's a coming-of-age story about a teenage girl named Adele who falls in love for the first time with a slightly older art student named Emma. It's controversial partly because of the sex scenes. One of the sex scenes is over 7 minutes long. But I have to...
Did you time it?
It's been widely cited as being almost 10 minutes long.
Fine.
I think that something that should be kept in mind, all the scenes are very long in this. Her making dinner is a very long scene. Her in the classroom is a very long scene. Everything's kind of long, and it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea, but it's a great, great character study. I thought it was terrific.
To both of you, the Movie Date podcast, of course, has lots more of you every week, and you can go to thetakeaway.org and find it. But you've got a live event. What's happening?
That's right.
We're very lucky. We have our first live event coming up. It's going to be in Brooklyn. So if you happen to be in New York on Sunday, it's going to be a bar haunted Halloween trivia night on the
Scary movies,
spooky history, all of it at the Pacific Standard Bar in Brooklyn on Sunday night at 8.
For more information on how you can meet Rafer and Kristen, go to thetakeaway.org. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway Movie Date podcast. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, John.
So a large part of Europe sounds a bit like this at the moment.
Enough is enough. Between friends, between allies, we need trust, we need confidence. And I think that this confidence has been shaken.
It's French European Commissioner Michel Barnier. More pushback from European governments outraged over allegations that the U.S. has hacked, bugged, and eavesdropped on their leaders' cell phone conversations. And the political and diplomatic fallout has intensified with German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French leader François Hollande both demanding talks and a full explanation from the U.S. Kurt Volker, former U.S. ambassador to NATO, joins me now. Kurt, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Ambassador, is this a lot of diplomatic theater or is this a real row?
It's a lot of both. On the one hand, clearly there is an upset that is felt by the publics in Europe, and the leaders have to respond to that. And probably even at the level of saying, like, this is my cell phone, these are my communications, and I'm frustrated over that. But there's also a lot of theater involved. I mean, every government in the world spies. Every government in the world tries to collect the best information that it can so it informs its own decision making. And we all do that and we all know that. When I was in government, I assumed that people were listening to my cell phone. You take a cell phone or you take a wireless connection on a laptop, and you're assuming that this is now out in the World Wide Web. It's wide open out there. So I can't believe that people are really that surprised that the ability is there for people to listen in on calls.
Part of this is the kind of, you know, celebrity outrage over the paparazzi following them everywhere. I mean, this is the price you pay for being, you know, a world leader on some level, as you've suggested. But I'm wondering if there's any advantage, if there's any sort of leverage here that the Germans and the French have that they're trying to gain with this flap that, you know, relates to other missions between the U.S. and Europe.
No, I wouldn't think so. I think I view it more in a context of domestic politics. I think that when this hits the papers in Europe or the United States, it seems very shocking and very dramatic, and the publics get upset. And so leaders have to show that they're upset, too, because otherwise then, you know, they would seem to be out of touch with the public feeling in their own country. But then internally, they also know they have their own very good intelligence services. They collect all sorts of things. And in fact, we actually share with each other a lot of the information that we collect from others around the world. So everyone knows this is going on, and it's a little bit of a calculated outrage at the top in order to respond to a genuine outrage among the publics.
Calculated or not, I loved this comment from former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright.
A lot of foreign policy is gossip. A lot of the things that have come out, I think, are specifically damaging because of they are negotiating positions and a variety of ways that we have to go about business. And I think it has made life very difficult for Secretary Kerry.
Is that the takeaway here, Kurt Volker, that John Kerry is the one who really, you know, feeling the pain here? It really doesn't matter other than, you know, his own problems?
Well, I think we have a phase right now where people are pillaring the U.S. for having done this, and that's going to make it difficult to get anything else done. The European Union is meeting and they're talking about what can they do to display unhappiness with the U.S., as opposed to talking about what can we do together to solve, for instance, the crisis in Syria. So it gets in the way of getting anything real done. I don't think it's a permanent thing, though. I mean, the real thing here is that the countries that we're talking about, the U.S., Europe, our allies there, maybe others around the world will emerge, whatever else comes out of these leaks. We're countries that basically share the same set of values. We're trying to do the same things in the world. We cooperate with each other on a number of levels. And the purposes of our gathering information are to help us do that better, to help us make the best decisions. Very, very different from countries like Iran or China or Russia that are gathering information for their purposes that are really very much at odds with our values and at odds with our interests. So I think when you get past the initial upset here, the long-term thing is that we really are on the same page with our European allies, right, and others, and really are trying to do the same things in the world.
And that's not going to change, although, as you say, and as someone who knows, as a former U.S. ambassador, some U.S. diplomats are going to have to listen to some nasty preambles in their talks. Absolutely. With world leaders. Kurt Volker, thanks so much.
You get paid for it.
Kurt Volker, former U.S. ambassador to NATO. What is Russia today? The miraculous fall of the Soviet Union brought liberation to Eastern Europe, ended the Cold War, and started a staggering reconciliation process for Europe, healing wounds that went back through two world wars to the end of the Napoleonic era. But it also created a horrible chaos in Russia, a wild east of crime. The population actually started to decline in Russia during the 90s. Government and the economy dysfunctional, even as it was on some level reforming. Today, the story of Russia can perhaps best be told in the case of former oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who gained incalculable wealth during the chaos of the 90s, but upon entering politics and challenging the corruption of Russia's political class, was arrested in October of 2003 for tax evasion, fraud, and embezzlement, exactly 10 years ago today. Khodorkovsky, who once headed the oil giant Yukos, has always maintained he is the casualty of Russian politics and corruption. He makes the argument today in the New York Times in a blistering critique of Vladimir Putin, quote, "When a regime that has unknowingly entered a stage of irreversible degeneration and is highly reluctant to give its opponents the space for real political competition, the only hope for change lies in the success of a broad-based, peaceful protest movement." Khodorkovsky is set to be released next August, but will Vladimir Putin let his most vocal critic go free? Joining us now in studio is Pavel Khodorkovsky, son of Russian dissident Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Let's begin by really just describing what the status of your father is at this point legally. It appears as though his sentence is running out and he'll be released, but you never know in Russia.
It's true. Certainly, there is always this possibility that something would change, but there judicial system as a whole has been collapsing for the past 10 years. But there is a lot of political pressure, especially in such landmark cases like the case of my father, the case of Pussy Riot Band, and now the case of the Greenpeace activists in Russia.
Is this about oil? Is this about ego? Or is this about somebody's vision of what Russia now should be? And it's looking a lot more like the Soviet Union than it certainly has in the last 20 years in my lifetime.
In reality, it's all of those three factors combined. It initially was about politics and oil, because the way that Igor Sechin was able to persuade and justify the necessity to incarcerate my father was this idea that Russian state needs to renationalize its primary production, you know, and export resources. And of course, Yukos Oil Company was the prime target, the prime example, because it was very successful back in the year 2003. So that allowed the state to sort of regain its influence, both domestically and on the geopolitical arena. It was about ego, because my father has called out, essentially, the government on corruption. And it was done in a public manner, and my father made the mistake of actually assuming that the government will react positively to this revelation. As a matter of fact, they've done the opposite.
If there's a vision of Vladimir Putin of what Russia should be, is it that the whole country is now a kind of happy gulag under the illusion of freedom, but that essentially the state controls everything and will take the most aggressive steps against anyone who criticizes it, even in a small way?
Well, it's much more nuanced today than it was back in the Soviet times, because the Soviet pressure on the society was guided primarily by ideology. Today, there is very little ideology, and the absence of ideology and at the same time all of these internal pressures is actually one of the main achievements of the regime, because all of those who are discontent leave and are free to do so. The borders are no longer closed. But Putin's vision for Russia is certainly no longer in line with what the country needs as a nation to go on, not for the past 10 years, but for the next 10 or 20 or 30 years. The economy needs to modernize. We're highly dependent still on hydrocarbon exports. And people knew this 10 years ago and knew that there need to be steps taken before it becomes a problem. So now we're edging closer and closer to the threshold, and the leader that we have today does not seem to realize that reforms need to be made now.
And one of those reforms, Putin believes, is maybe to enshrine him as leader indefinitely.
Well, he is effectively in his fourth presidential term, because the time that he has shared with Medvedev in the previous cycle was mostly attributed to his overwhelming influence on Russian society and politics, even when he was in the prime minister's seat. There seems to be no limit to how many times the constitution may be amended. It has been done before, and it certainly could be done again. So we may be, from that perspective, facing an indefinite rule. However, there is another thing that's been recently happening, I would say since 2011. The society has realized that they're no longer observers, but citizens. And even though this group of people is comparatively small, but it's growing. And the people that have participated since 2011 in public protests are demanding those reforms, the reforms that are necessary for the country to advance. So I don't think that in the long-term picture we're actually facing the same fate as the countries that have had the same leader for 30 or 40 years.
Pavel Khodorkovsky, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Pavel Khodorkovsky is the son of Russian dissident Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who is due to be released from prison in Russia in August of next year. He's already been in prison for 10 years. The first real chill of mid-autumn this week brought a chill of memory for people in the New York area who experienced Hurricane Sandy and its aftermath.
Hurricane Sandy crashing on shore.
There's a lot of damage along the Milford coastline. Very tough to get around.
The waters to come up from the East River to this level would be devastating.
The entire hospital and our nursing home as well is going to be evacuated.
This is my hood, and I'm staying right here. I want to see what happens.
I'm praying there's not going to be another one. I'm praying I'm not going to be here for the next one.
Gives me a chill to hear that. There are so many ways in which Sandy changed the reality for this city. Today, everybody knows who lives in Zone A, the mandatory evacuation zone. Each neighborhood has a story, is a story. WNYC reporter Jim O'Grady went back to the now unfortunately named Ocean Breeze neighborhood in Staten Island, a place where both the ocean and the wind became a killer a year ago. 13 people died there, the highest death rate, Sandy's cruelest victory over the innocent people in her path. People like 65-year-old Diane Norris and her 89-year-old mom, Ella, who had heard warnings before about big storms, but weren't about to leave their home.
We had left the year before, I think it was for Irene. We had a mandatory evacuation. And when we came back after that, nothing had happened. So that's why we didn't leave this time. Who would think that the ocean would rise that high?
But the ocean did rise. And not even Big Bear of a Man Santo Lisa, Diane Norris's next-door neighbor, could do much to help.
I'm standing on my back deck,
And I'm hearing her, please help me. And I'm saying, where are you at? So she showed me a flashlight. I says, you know what? I'm going to get you help. If I can't get there, so I called 911 at least 5 times. And they kept on telling, we're going to get somebody there. We're going to get somebody. I says, listen, I'm a fireman. I know what's going on here. I says, I cannot get there, no matter what. You need a boat, you need a helicopter or something. This woman's going to die. They never got here.
It is reporter Jim O'Grady who spoke to these people in Ocean Breeze, who gained their trust, and in return he got to see the pain of their memories, of how little they could do in the face of Sandy, isolated, vulnerable, barely surviving, in some cases not surviving.
Nobody could get to them. You know, Sandy brought chaos throughout large parts of New York. So Diane and her mother Ella were trapped in their house. The water was not only rising, it was rushing through the house. They were in the dark. The water was freezing. Diane was holding her mother. But after some hours, her mother said to her, I can't do this anymore. And she died in her daughter's arms. And Diane even said to me that after some time, she couldn't even hold her mother anymore. She had to let her go. And her mother was floating in the room.
What are those memories like now, a year later? What is the sense of the people, the sense of the trauma that they've been through, the sense that you can see the storm even on a clear day in their eyes?
You know, it's interesting, John. I talked to these three different people for this story, and they had three different ways of coping with trauma that I saw. Diane seems to be sort of emotionally flat when she talks about it. Santo is a former fireman. He's a burly guy. He worked the job for 30 years. He's used to saving people. But that night he was on his deck hearing a cry for help and he couldn't help.
But it was like grasping for straws because I know what I'm capable of. And I'm not a bad swimmer, but I'm not a great swimmer. I would have to be surfing down there. You would have found me in the swamps at the end of the night. It was horrible. It was the horriblest thing. All that we've gone through, I never had the feeling in the pit of my stomach that I couldn't help.
He feels survivor's guilt. His wife, Gail, in the weeks after the storm, would find herself outside her house just sitting there crying.
I would just lash out and, you know, I was like a wreck and I was more like ranting and carrying on and I was mad at everything and everybody. I'm doing much better. I don't cry every day anymore and I'm laughing a little bit more, so I'm grateful for that. I do group. I do one-on-one. I'm on medication.
These people, and you talk to so many out there in that particular community, all understand that they've gone through something that will and has changed them forever.
Yeah. Gail is, you can hear the arc of her year there. She started out lashing out. She got some help, and now she's doing a little better, slowly. And this is typical. There are so many people who are still feeling the effects of Sandy. As a matter of fact, there was a Gallup survey last January that showed a 25% increase in depression diagnoses, clinical diagnoses of depression in people who lived in zip codes affected by Sandy. That's an extraordinary increase.
That 25% increase, according to the study, represents about 540,000 adults, and it doesn't even take into account kids or milder mental health effects. We've gotten callers and texters who actually say, I'm only realizing now the effects that Sandy has had on me.
That's Christian Burgess from the Mental Health Association of New York.
Yes.
Now, he experienced the storm. You experienced the storm, right?
Right.
I experienced the storm.
Yeah.
What was it like for you going back to that neighborhood? Storm scared me, still scares me. I've covered hurricanes before. Mm. Did you have feelings experiencing the memories of these folks, even in yourself?
I have, that's a great question. I have felt a little more hopeful each time I go out there because when I first went out there, there was giant piles of debris everywhere. People were clearly shocked. But month after month, they've gotten things somewhat together. Some people have even started repairing their homes. But you do hear this simmering under the surface.
So in this case, a reporting assignment was really a form of therapy for you.
It was. I felt lucky that these people entrusted their stories to me. And every month I would go to visit, say, Stephen Dramalis, and I would see his front steps were there. They were back instead of cinder blocks. I would see he had paint on his walls. I would see his bathroom wasn't a mess. And slowly, his mental state was better.
In the case of Diane Norris, well, you can listen. She's one tough woman.
It's almost a year, and I miss her like the same day it happened. I cry almost every day. I haven't gone to see anybody about it yet. I miss her like crazy. My heart is still broken.
A woman who lost her mother a year ago.
Yeah.
Where is she now?
She's about an hour north of New York City in Goshen, New York, living with her niece. You know what? She really misses the old block, the old house, her neighbors, but she doesn't know if she'll ever be back.
And the storm lives with her.
Yeah.
And it lives with all the people that you talk with. Jim O'Grady, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
WNYC reporter Jim O'Grady reporting on the trauma that Sandy left behind here in the region. We'll have more coverage on the one-year anniversary of Sandy next week, looking at how the community of the Rockaways in Queens is recovering today.
I saw the water running down the driveway. It started to come under the door, and I remember Claire going, "Oh my God, the water's coming under the door."
And I wrap up in the blanket like this, and all I'm saying, "Lord, save me. Save me, Lord. Don't let the house go."
So when I looked through this window, I saw that the water, like we're in the middle of the ocean. The whole place was surrounding like that. And I hear the water knocking on the door and banging and people screaming and crying out, "Help me," and all that.
It's not just, oh, this is a house or something that I own. It's also become a part of our identity.
I know why I'm here. I have salt running in my blood.
If we can unite the community around this, saying, like, we get it, like, you need more money, but, you know, you can't decimate a neighborhood because people can't afford flood insurance. We need the voices to be together.
And later in the week, we'll talk with Science Friday's Ira Flatow on the science of climate change and what Sandy has taught us about how to better prepare for severe weather. All that and much more on The Takeaway. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.